Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.
Hello and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Ben. Hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone, indeed. Yes, I can hear myself better now. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM, where our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032, and you can also catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast. Let's get straight into it, John. What to see in the night sky?
Yes, and we still have to wait another week and a bit to see our space station in the evening skies. This is one of the times it just drags and drags and drags.
Yeah, but if you're up early on Thursday morning at 3:30, it's beginning a series of morning passes beginning on the 16th. The 16th? Or the 26th, I should say, which is Thursday morning, 3:31 a.m., which will be visible. But that's
I'll be there.
I will not be up at that time.
Yep, July the 6th is when it comes in, and we'll give you more details next week of the time limit. It's going to be around until July the 23rd, which is good as well. Today, what, the 23rd, 4th. Jupiter in conjunction with the Sun. That means that the Jupiter's behind the Sun. Is that be right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So you won't, it's only 0.1 of a degree, so it's just below, seemingly, the Sun's centre, behind the Sun's disk as well. So don't even try and look at that one, because you're not going to see it as well. Mercury, it remains very low in the afterglow of sunset, and it's around for about 40 to 60 minutes after sundown, depending where you are. Look for it a little above your west-northwest horizon. West-northwest. Yep. Have it. It's slowly fading there from minus 0.2. That'll be on June the 20th to plus 0.2 by the 27th. That's quite quick for dimming that quickly.
Fading rapidly.
Yep. Venus, it's still brilliant at a magnitude of minus 4.3. It rises above the east northeast horizon about half an hour just before the beginning of dawn. Yep, I've seen that as well. It's a weird UFO if you're not expecting it. So its background constellation is Aries, and Venus climbs higher until the dawn sky grows too bright for it, and you just can't see it anymore. Mars, it's drawing further away from Regulus at the moment in the west after dark. These are quite interesting to watch as the evening goes through, because we've had sort of good, we've had a few good evenings, and we've had a few poor evenings, but on the good ones, they're really good. You get a good chance to see all these as well. So Jupiter, as I mentioned, is out of sight in conjunction with the Sun. Saturn, plus one, and it's at the border of Aquarius and Pisces, rises around 1 a.m. I saw that the other night, and Uranus, out of sight, low in the dawn, not really any chance of seeing that, and Neptune, still a telescopic star. I think that's whoever invented that one is brilliant. So it's a magnitude 7.9, and it lurks in Saturn's background for about 1 degree from it as well. So that's all there is in the sky at the moment. I don't know where the moon is. Oh, I do, because I was up, was it yesterday morning, and it's rising quite late. It's rising sort of 2 to 3 in the morning as well, and it's a beautiful thumbnail at the moment.
We're coming up to the full moon. Actually, the new moon, I should say, is on tomorrow morning, about 11:30 to be precise. At the moment, we have a 0.7%. I don't think you'd spot that, would you? That's a waning crescent moon, because it's very thin, waning. As I mentioned, we're coming up to new moon tomorrow. It is currently above the horizon, but it's very close to the Sun, and it's that's such a thin crescent moon, less than 1%, that I doubt if you would. Hey, if anybody out there spot it without blinding themselves,
you have a better chance of seeing it early in the morning hours. It appears
It will set tonight at 9:57 p.m. It'll have shrunk another little bit. And that's around about the same time as the sun is setting. So I'm not sure whether it's a little to the west of it or to the east of it now at this stage. I think it's to the left-hand side of it. Not sure about that at the moment. But it will rise again tomorrow morning. The 25th, tomorrow morning, at just after 4 a.m., where it'll be down to 0.3%, but that's, you'd never catch that. And when it is due south, as I mentioned then, when it rises tomorrow at 4 a.m. in the morning, it's still a waning crescent, and then we'll have the new moon at 11:30, and by the time it's due south at 1:30, it'll be a 0.2% waxing crescent moon, as opposed to a waning crescent moon, because we'd be the other side of the new moon. And then it'll set tomorrow night at 11:05. And again, by that stage, it's still only about 0.6% a waxing crescent moon. Which brings us to the sun rising in tomorrow. Sun rises tomorrow in Dublin. That's Wednesday the 25th at 4:58 a.m., which is 2 minutes.
A few minutes
later than a week ago.
That's strange.
More than it's kind of closing. Not, you wouldn't really notice it though.
No.
And local noon in Dublin, that's when the sun is at its highest and is due south, crosses the meridian at 1:27 p.m. and sets tomorrow at 9:57 p.m. 1 minute later than a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
So actually tonight, Tuesday the 24th, is the latest sunrise from our vantage point here in Dublin. Now, there's only a few seconds between that tonight and tomorrow and yesterday, but technically speaking, tonight is the latest sunset. And as I mentioned, tomorrow it'll set at 9:57 p.m., 1 minute later than a week ago, and then we'll have civil twilight until 10:49 p.m., which is also 1 minute later than a week ago, and then nautical twilight until 22 minutes past midnight, and we'll have astronomical twilight after that until about 2:30 in the morning on the 26th, and then we're back into nautical twilight. So there's no astronomical night until the end of July, around about the 30th. Astronomical night being defined as when the sun is 18 degrees or more below the horizon. So that means, compared with this time last week, of course, since we were here last week, we had the solstice on Friday. But compared with this day last week, we have 1 minute more daylight than a week ago, and the rate of change now is only 26 seconds per day. Tomorrow we'll have 26 seconds less daylight than today, when there'll be 16 hours and 55 minutes between sunrise and sunset. Have you seen any noctilucent clouds? It's that time of the year. I have had reports of them, but I haven't. Yeah. I've been looking out for them in the evenings. Those
I've
beautiful
seen
blue, wispy
some
electric
photographs
blue.
Photographs of them
clouds.
From the US, all right, on, you know, different versions of whatever media you're using. They do put them up everywhere. But over here, no, I have not as yet.
Yeah, me neither. So don't forget, just to go back to the planets for a moment, Wednesday the 26th, tomorrow evening, Mercury is 5.5 degrees to the left of the moon, and, oh yes, by the way, Thursday, did you know Thursday 27th, the Islamic New Year, Muharram, the year 1447, and, oh, the debuted meteor shower peaks also on Thursday, but this time of the year is not a great time for meteors because, as we know, the sky doesn't really get very dark at this time of the year. And then Saturday 28, Mercury is at dichotomy. In other words, you can see, basically, if you see it through a small telescope or such, it'll be half a disc, like a half moon. And on Sunday the 29th in the evening, Mars will be 2 degrees to the upper left of the moon. Also on that morning, Saturn and Neptune are just over 1 degree apart. Oh, and don't forget Monday the 30th. Asteroid Day. Perhaps we'll do more of that, but it's basically an international day to make people aware of the dangers of asteroids, well, more of that on the moment, in a moment actually, yeah. About an asteroid that could possibly hit the moon in the year 2032,
yeah.
And the damage it could, what could happen if it does, and the effect here for satellites and for I'm going to say meteor showers, but they won't be, they could possibly cause a lot of damage to a lot of satellites, breaking them up, which would then fall gradually back to Earth, and we could have these massive, what looks like meteor showers, but they'd actually be thousands of pieces of
debris
from satellites. But we'll go into a bit more detail of that in a moment.
Now, I have to speak about the first results, the first stunning images from the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, which were released yesterday, which sort of came streaming in this morning early on the TV, etc. as well. The images are just stunning for these. And this is the one that is an optical one that we use here on Earth. So, and they told us how many megapixels were in this. Now, we were speaking about a camera last week with 40.2 megapixels. 320 megapixels is what the Vera Rubin Observatory's camera has. So you can virtually just take a snap and just zoom in wherever you want, and you'll get absolutely stunning images from that zooming and bringing it out to the size of a wall as well. So this particular thing, it will revolutionise astronomy, one of its primary aims being the investigation of dark energy. It's weird stuff, that. That's something that most of us just don't understand. In fact, nearly all of us don't. And it's just to describe what it is. It's the mysterious force driving and accelerating the expansion of the universe, and of course dark matter as well. So it's really, I think, as they describe it, the glue of dark matter would be the glue holding everything in position. It's sort of a little gravitational field as well. So it's in Chile, this particular telescope. It's a perch atop the Cerro Pachón in Chile. It's a mountain that rises 5,200 feet, which is only 1,600 metres above sea level, but it's out above clouds most of the time. It scans the entire night sky over the southern hemisphere once every three nights. This, from the results this morning, were saying it's a very, very fast telescope, taking pictures very, very quickly. So they're scanning everywhere in the universe at the moment as quickly as they possibly can. It's an 8.4 metre survey telescope, and it has the largest digital camera, which is around the size of a small car. So we've got cameras now the size of small cars as well. So remember that name. Please Google away. It's the Rubens Observatory's first images of the universe. And when you look at it first, you think it's just a bunch of stars from a tiny pin thing. It goes back millions of years. In fact, billions of years. And they are, in fact, galaxies. In the photograph, I get the odd star here and there as well, but most of the photographs, like, I don't remember, you remember the first one from Hubble, which was it's one of his first pictures. You think it was just a picture of stars, but in fact it was all galaxies. And there are quite a few of them out there. So is there life out there, I wonder? Has to be. We're not going to find them. We're too blooming far away. That's the problem, isn't it, really?
Yeah. We're not going to find out in the next 15 minutes.
No, we certainly aren't. No, so the Vera C. Rubin Observatory, just keep an eye out for that, and hit the internet button with that fella and just have a look at some of the results. Brilliant.
Thank you, John. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text on WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. Catch us on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast. Now, John, you know I'm a fan of total solar eclipses. Well, something we mentioned a few weeks or months ago anyway was the Probitree, the European Space Agency's dual satellite mission, and it has achieved its, actually, what they call a historic milestone. They captured the first images of the sun's outer atmosphere during an artificial solar eclipse in orbit. So what they do is they use this very advanced formation flying. There are two spacecraft aligned with millimeter level precision to simulate a total eclipse, and this enables them to take high resolution observations of the solar corona. It was back in March when the coronagraph and the Occulter spacecraft, they're the two spacecraft, they successfully flew within 150 meters apart. They held their position for hours, and the precise alignment allowed a 1.4 meter disc on the oculator to block the sun's bright surface for the coronagraph's instrument to take a photograph. And that the first one cast an 8-centimeter shadow that enabled uninterrupted imaging of the corona. So basically you have a disc blocking out the sun, but it has to be the correct distance from the first spacecraft so that it matches the apparent diameter of the sun, just like the moon does. Mm-hmm. But of course, in this case, it's precision flying. And the good thing about this is you can take, they can be aligned for about 6 hours now. Now, the longest possible total solar eclipse for us mere mortals here on the planet is 7 minutes or so. But, you can have a 6 hour eclipse, which is a pretty good going. And then you can, I don't know how often you can do that. Yeah, the 6 hours per orbit, and then you can do that just under every 20 hours. Have a 6 hour eclipse. So you can do a lot of studying of the sun's outer corona. Mm. Which
I was looking at your photograph you sent me way back in Texas last night. It came up on my phone for some reason. It just
look at the spring photograph.
Yeah, well, there you go.
It's not the greatest photograph.
Something's fantastic to see. A total eclipse from my armchair, if you like.
Well, to see it in reality is... No, I have yet to see a photograph or video that actually does it justice in real life. It's just an amazing experience.
Yeah.
And I was there... Sorry, just reminds me, I was... when I went to, Texas and with my daughter, and, of course, she was amazed, obviously, but she was banging on about it so much to a friend of hers... That who had never seen a total solar eclipse, she was so convincing that this guy has already booked his accommodation in northern Spain.
Yeah,
for
1 minute and a half. Yeah,
for one and a half. Yeah, it's a very short one from Spain next year. The longest I think is if you go up to Greenland, but it's a very a place that's very difficult to get to. And I think maybe it passes by the southwestern tip of Iceland.
Yeah, we'll go into it later as we get closer to it, I think.
Yes.
Just to remind people, you're not booked yet, evidently.
No.
You can probably sleep in a field or something. Or up on the side of a mountain. Mm. Be nice and warm.
Well, it is. Yeah. It will be in August. Midland, northern. Yeah. I'm thinking of a place north east of Madrid. But at that time of the year, that part of the country, hot. Hotter than I like it.
There you go.
I shall suffer for my art.
Can we go back just to the booted meteor shower, just to explain exactly what it is? It peaks on June the 27th, and it is we sort of go through the tail of this from June the 22nd until July the 2nd, so you get to see a few extra ones here and there, but it's because it's so bright in the evening, you don't get to see it for too long, because it's after midnight at the moment, it's only dark for... It's remarkable, isn't it?
Well, we have 2.5 hours of nautical or astronomical twilight, I should say, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's in the constellation of Bootes, in case you are interested. And it had a link as well. I don't know if I've ever seen any of those. I'm going to keep my eye out for these particular ones as well. And just as a reminder, each day around 48.5 tonnes, which is 44,000 kilograms, of ancient debris dating back to the creation of our solar system collide with our Earth's atmosphere, the planet here, according to NASA. And upon striking the atmosphere, these particles or meteors swiftly burn up, leaving the stunning trails that can be easily visible to the naked eye. So every now and again we go through the tails of comets, and you get a sort of an extension of how many meteor lights the skies, and as they burn up, some of them are long ones, some of them are short ones, depending on the size of the grains of sand or whatever they are. And we've got to look towards the booted ones. And then we have the Geminis in August. Yeah, that's a pretty good one.
Probably the best. It's a good one in August and the one in...
Yeah.
Is it December?
Yeah, that's Perseids.
The Perseids.
Yeah.
Can't remember which ones are in August and which ones
Anyway, it doesn't really matter. We still get to see them, but they are fantastic to see. There's no doubt about it. You want to get out from sort of midnight as well. So just put that in the diary for June the 27th at the peak of that one.
Thank you, John. Now, what we alluded to earlier about the Earth's satellites, many of them are at risk. If an asteroid, a particular asteroid, smashes into the moon, asteroid has been heavily monitored, its course plotted, but we covered earlier this year, remember about, there were fears that a certain 60-meter wide asteroid called 2024 YR4 would strike the Earth on December 22nd, 2032, and that's big enough to destroy a whole city, but it may crash into the moon in 2032. And such an explosion would send debris streaming towards Earth, and that would mean that a lot of satellites in orbit around Earth could be knocked apart and broken up, which would create, as we mentioned, perhaps millions of pieces, which would eventually float back to Earth, and we could have this massive meteor shower, except it wouldn't be normal meteors like bits of rock and dust, of which meteors are normally made, but actually man-made bits of metal and well, mostly metal. However, and that one that we thought had a 3% chance at one stage of hitting the Earth, but now that's been ruled out. However, there's a 4.3% chance that it may crash into the moon instead. And if it crashes on the Earth-facing side of the moon, it could throw up so much debris, as we mentioned earlier, it could flatten the city here on Earth. But if it hit the moon on the Earth-facing side, it could throw up so much rock and dirt and grit and boulders that would head towards Earth, as we mentioned, and maybe destroy thousands, perhaps, of satellites, which would break those up into thousands of pieces, and then it could be thousands of thousands, which is millions. Mm. You could go out one night and there could be millions and millions of what look like meteors. That would be fascinating to see, but I'm not sure economically it wouldn't be too good for all those people who spent all that money sending up all those satellites. But it would be a spectacular display for sure. They say a few days after this could happen, there could be more than 1,000 times the normal number of meteors threatening Earth satellites. That's just the satellites, and then if the satellites break up into thousands of pieces, you could be talking to millions of meteors.
Yeah, if you're into the megatons, it's about 6.5 megatons of energy, and it would create a 3,200-foot crater as well. This asteroid is about 200 feet in diameter. As they say, it's slightly more likely to crash into the moon than it was a little time ago as well, which was at 3.8%. It's now increased to 4.3% probability. That's still not a lot, really, is it?
No, it's only 1 in 25-ish, but...
And they've still time to give it a nudge if they need to, that's the other thing.
Well, that's the other part of it, too. Hence, these asteroid deflection missions and research that is being done at the moment. Moving on now, we could go to... what do you want to talk about now?
there's so much stuff out there, it just is incredible. Lunar dust seemingly poses a lower health risk than urban air pollution, so the study shows. This is the news for the research by the University of Technology, Sydney, and it has revealed that lunar dust is considerably less toxic to human lung cells than typical Earth-based air pollution. That's a bit hard to believe as well, because that moon dust stuff is really, really sticky. You've seen a bit of that, have you? Or is it just a bit of rock you've seen?
I've seen both. Yeah, I've seen the regolith in Houston, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think I've seen it here as well somewhere. Can't remember.
Yeah, so they say it poses lower. Mind you, who'd be breathing in?
There can't be much of that floating around, can
you? You put a bit in your hand and go, see what happens. Mm. You get yourself checked. very quickly as well. So.
Thank you, John. Very briefly, just in a acknowledgement to Pride Month, I didn't know, remember the American astronaut, Sally Ride, that she was gay, which I didn't know. And, of course, she has departed. She has shuffled off her mortal coil. But there's a lady by the name of Christina Constantini who has made a film about her, and she said she thought she would be just looking back on sexism and homophobia of yesteryear. But actually, back in... She was on board the space shuttle, the Challenger, back in 1983. She became the first U.S. woman to fly to space, and that was over... 2 decades after the first woman, Valentina Tereshkova, made the voyage. And apparently NASA only started allowing women to apply as astronaut recruits back in 1977. And naturally enough, of course, she received the same training as male astronauts, but apparently she was treated quite differently. And the thing I'm kind of amazed that journalists asked her whether she cried when facing difficulty. And NASA engineers asked about what makeup she would need in space, and they even worried about her whether she would have enough tampons for a 6-day journey into space. And she struggled to come to terms with her status as an she's a very private person, said her partner of 27 years, but and she died back in. She was only 61 when she died back in 2012 from pancreatic cancer, yes. Which is
a nasty. Sad, that's nasty.
Sad. Mm. But some of the questions she was asked. Oh, yeah. There are also reports that the U.S. Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, wants to change the name of the Navy ship currently named after the famous gay activist Harvey Milk. And Sally Ride's partner said... there's a research vessel called Sally Ride, and across my mind, she said that they might change that too. That would be sad indeed if it's come to that.
I don't know if you saw this one. Japan's second biggest car maker.
Oh yes, Honda.
I suppose behind Toyota, has successfully tested an experimental reusable rocket. They said, as it seeks to expand to the space sector. So Honda, which hopes to develop the tech prowess for a suborbital launch in 2029, or by 2029, just whenever they're ready, and they conducted a test flight of its rocket in the northern Japanese island of Hokkaido. If I was to go there, that is definitely on my bucket list, is the island in the winter, because there is some snowfall up there. The test was completed successfully, the first time Honda landed a rocket after reaching its altitude, as we discussed earlier on, of how many metres?
A whole mass of 300 metres.
There's a success, the company said, just on, was that Tuesday this morning, Tuesday or last week?
Last Tuesday.
Yeah. And the prototype device, around 6 metres, 20 feet tall, landed only 37 centimetres from its designated landing spot, so it's pretty accurate. So we'll come and see what happens there. So they're going to, I suppose they would keep it up north because it's less populated than the island of Hokkaido, which I'm very familiar with from the television programs as well.
Probably also too, because it's nearer the, you need a little less energy to launch space from, yeah. If you're near the poles or nearer the equator,
And it's
which is why the NASA launch from Florida, because it's nearer the equator. But still they got, even though it was only 300 metres, but the engineering to get it up and then to land back within centimetres of where they planned is, that's certainly a success. And that's all we have the time for this evening. Well, unfortunately, we're now out of time yet again. Thank you, John, for your news items and for driving the sound desk. But that's all for me, Ben Emmett, from this edition of the Astronomy Show. And it's musing all the way now until 2 a.m. here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Because up next we have Dublin's Greatest Hits, followed at 10 p.m. to midnight by Nigel Wood, who has his world music mix. And from midnight till 2 a.m., Dave Barry with a program called After Hours, and that's his mix of jazz, blues, soul, etc. But please join myself and John at the same time, 7:30 p.m. next week. We'll be back with all the latest news from all corners and dimensions of the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening, and say goodnight, John.
Good night, John.
Good night, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.